today to actually look at what are the things that we need to do, the steps and programs that we need to put in place to ensure that this dream is realized, that this program of action actually get realized. What are the contributions that both of us, as both the Department of Labor and Economic Development, what are those things that we can jointly do that will help poor South Africans out there, people who do not have jobs, people who are at the receiving end of the impacts of economic crises in the world. We are not immune from those, as we are part of the global village. So we are affected by what is happening throughout the world. There have been lots of discussions in the country about that for us to grow the economy, we need to do some amputation, you know, actually cut your limb to ensure that you... I don't know who will we be appeasing, you know, to grow this economy. We need to compromise even on our constitutional right of South Africans, the right to work, the right to a better life. How else do you achieve a better life if you do not have access to employment? How does your children get access to education if their parents are unemployed? So we are here today to share ideas and look at programs, both programs, if our programs are talking to one another. And if they are not, how do we align them so that they help us achieve the ultimate goal, that of bettering lives of South Africans? I'll give first over to the Department of Economic Development to give us a briefing, give their presentation, and immediately after that, you'll be followed by Economic Department of Labor, and then we can jointly discuss the document, the two presentations, because they are talking to each other, or they should be talking to each other. Thank you very much. Over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, and thank you very much for this opportunity for us to share the new growth path with this committee. Indeed, as you've indicated, for us in the new growth path, employment is at the center of the whole economic development strategy and the new growth path going forward. But there are challenges, and the challenge really is that economic growth since 1994 has equaled the average for middle-income countries. But South Africa remains one of the most inequitable countries in the world, where unemployment is far higher than the norm, and apartheid has left deep inequalities in asset ownership and access to education. We also have a challenge of emissions intensity, which is very high in our country, mostly due to smelting and the refining of mining products. And we have a further problem of employment and private investment having dropped sharply in the downturn, which you referred to, and they have not yet recovered. The problem, however, is not slow growth. GDP growth from the late 1970s until 1994 was well below the norm for middle-income countries. From 1994 to 2008, it was just at the norm and faster than, for instance, Brazil. But structurally, unemployment is really where our problem is. The share of the working age population with employment fell from the late 1970s to a low of 40% in the mid-1990s. There has been some improvement since then, but this was largely reversed with the downturn in 2008. And even at the high point in 2007, the employment ratio lagged far behind the international norm of 60%, the rate of labor absorption in the economy. If we look at the issue of wages and equality, South Africa does rank amongst the most unequal countries in the world, where the richest 10% of households gets over 40% of household income, and the poorest 20% gets under 2%, a frightening statistic by any standards. At the end of 2010, the median monthly income for employees overall was 2,800 Rand. It was 1,000 Rand for domestic workers, 20% of employed African women, and 1,200 in agriculture. And we are in a situation where low pay and unemployment still align with race, gender, and location. So we've got this massive structural inequality in our society, which obviously we need to address. But why? Now, we know that apartheid entrenched systems that marginalize the majority, especially given a mining-based economy. And these systems have been reproduced despite the advent of democracy, where we have highly inequitable access to assets, including land and to education and skills development. And apartheid residential patterns leave many working people far from employment centers, both nationally and within towns. Production structures are not friendly to employment creation. We have a situation whereby mining and agriculture have been shedding jobs for 30 years, but mining still accounts for over half of total exports. The fastest growing sector in our economy has been the financial sector, which does not generate much employment at all. So most new jobs in the 2000s are in services for households, retail, construction, and business services. So there is an overarching challenge in our economy, and that is to revitalize our core productive sectors. Now, just to speak to the settlement patterns, if we look at those two maps here, this is where we see the problem of the reproduction of apartheid spatial settlement. Spatial geography of apartheid persists. So if we look at the population distribution in 2007 and then we look at the map of the Bantustans, we see that the former Bantustan areas are still the areas where we have large concentrations of our people. And what we see here is the percentage of the population and the employment ratio. And this basically shows us the problems of unemployment certainly coincide with our historical settlement patterns, where we still have major problems of unemployment in the former Bantustan area, 17 million people, one in four adults employed, compared with two in four adults in the rest of the country. So we have this persistent problem here. Now, in terms of the downturn from late 2008 wiped out over a million jobs, and this returned our joblessness to levels of the early 2000s. The employment creation returned only at the start of 2011, after around 2 years of economic growth, so the problem of jobless growth persisted. And young adults comprise a third of employed people, but accounted for 60% of job losses. And this just gives an indication of the distribution of employment, and shows the patterns of employment, and shows where we shed a lot of jobs, and it shows, for instance, the patterns of job shedding in the agriculture sector, for example, is quite clearly illustrated in this chart over here, where we have been consistently shedding jobs since September 2002 through to 2011. Now, the new growth path targets the creation of 5 million new jobs over the next 10 years, and it focuses on the fine-tuning of macro and micro policies to support more equitable and employment-intensive growth through measures to make the economy as a whole more competitive, including the value of the currency, infrastructure, skills, and intermediate and wage goods. It also systematically encourages more labor-intensive and green activities with a greater focus on domestic and regional markets. It supports broad-based ownership and more equitable education and skills as a basis for long-term equity. And social dialogue and solidarity are central to the process of transformation envisaged through the implementation of the fine-tuning of macro and micro policies in line with the new growth path. And then there is a major drive within the new growth path to monitor the impact of state actions of all kinds on employment as a basis for improvement. So we are establishing together with the Department of Performance Monitoring in the Presidency a monitoring evaluation system which hopefully will force all departments at national, provincial, and ultimately down to local level to look at the impact of all their programs and policies on employment creation, because employment creation lies at the center of the strategy of the new growth path. Increasing employment intensity is central. In order to achieve the jobs target, we need growth and greater employment intensity of growth. And that's the increase of employment relative to the growth in the GDP. And employment intensity, and this is what this graph is trying to illustrate, of 0.2% would require a growth rate of over 15%, whereas an employment intensity of 0.8% would require a growth rate of 4%. So it's not only about growth, it's about the composition of that growth. And employment intensity obviously is critical, whereby if we have greater employment intensity, then we can still, on the basis of a lower growth rate, achieve the kind of employment creation which we need to achieve. The reality that we need to accept, however, as well, is that very few middle-income economies have grown faster than 5% a year for long periods. The notable exceptions, of course, are China and India. And that's why the employment intensity is critical rather than just focusing on the growth rate. So if the financial sector continues to grow and we look like we've got a GDP above 5% is not going to give us the result we want in terms of employment creation. And that's basically what we saw in the 2000s. So obviously we need to achieve the return to jobs growth. Now, basically, if we look at the new growth path, what we're saying is that we need to look for employment opportunities in the jobs drivers that we've identified and implement policies to take advantage of them. And these are the jobs drivers we've identified: infrastructure, the main economic sectors, agriculture and agro-processing, mining and beneficiation, manufacturing, tourism and other services, the new economies, the green economy and the knowledge economy, social capital, the social economy, the cooperative sector, as well as the public sector, and then look at spatial opportunities in terms of rural development and African regional development. So these are the key jobs drivers contained within the new growth path, where we need to find employment opportunities and then put in place the necessary policy framework and implementation of that policy in order to take advantage of these. Now, innovations around the jobs drivers include sustained high public investment in infrastructure with stronger local procurement. We also have set ambitious targets for smallholders in agriculture linked to restructured land reform, comprehensive rural development, and expanded agro-processing. And mining to incentivize output growth plus beneficiation at stage four, not smelting and refining, with a focus on the priority sectors starting with steel. So not simply to extract the minerals out of the earth, but also then to beneficiate those minerals up to stage four. The green economy, where we're looking at a variety of interventions, from recycling to the installation of 1 million solar water heaters by 2015, and to manufacture the inputs for renewable energy, which we identify as a major new opportunity for growth in the economy. And then African regional development centered on driving improved infrastructure and economic value chains and taking advantage of some of the opportunities which have arisen, such as the establishment of a framework for a new free trade area which would embrace three of the regional economic communities, SADC, COMESA, and the East African Community. Now, macroeconomic policies are very much part of the new growth path, and the priorities for 2011-12 are to maintain public investment at around 9% of GDP. And this is now backed by an infrastructure commission established in the presidency, which is currently getting underway and defining its work program going forward. Then also to accelerate job schemes with a special focus on the community work program and the jobs fund as a best way of expanding employment opportunities in the very short run. There's also a task team which is focusing on the identification and addressing unnecessary blockages to private projects. These would include regulatory hindrances, water licensing, environmental impact assessments, electricity, energy issues, and difficulties in getting infrastructure. And then a more vigorous strategy to moderate prices for key industrial agricultural inputs and wage goods, including steel, fertilizers, and electricity, healthcare, food, logistics, and commuter transport. New regulations for local procurement, as well as the enforcement of 30 days payment by all state agencies, and the reform of broad-based black economic empowerment to increase incentives for supporting SMEs, skills development, local procurement, and employment creation, and then mobilizing and targeting investment in African regional infrastructure, building on the Development Finance Institution and state-owned enterprise investments in the region. There's also a big focus on a new way to work in government. We really need to create this agile, responsive learning state that we've been talking about to make sure we align around our core priorities across the state, to also work closely with stakeholders to ensure that the policies respect the realities as well as build broad support and consensus across the society. So the new growth path prioritizes employment, creating growth as the basis for alignment, and consistently assesses the impact of state policies, programs, and projects on employment, equity, economic growth, emissions, and it also facilitates social dialogue through improvements in structures and procedures, and also seeks to improve engagement between the spheres with agreement on a spatial perspective. And then consistent contingency planning to identify and manage local and global risks. Now, social dialogue, as we know, it's quite messy. It consumes a lot of time, but it's absolutely critical. Of course, we do face the risk in a context of the deep inequalities we have in society, that we will exhaust ourselves on policy polarization while the development crisis grows. So we need to deepen dialogue at national level, at sector level, at workplace levels. And we need to also strengthen social dialogue at all levels with NEDLAC at the apex. So there are a series of meetings under NEDLAC at the moment, which include high-level representatives of all constituencies. And there is an agreement to commence with the low-hanging fruit. In other words, let's find the areas where we can build consensus and from there move to some of the more complex areas where there's likely to be more disagreement. So we do have agreements on skills and human resource development. We have circulated the two accords which have already been signed through this process. But in the pipeline, we have emerging consensus around local procurement, enterprise development, the green economy, and others. We've also, through our work, supported the presidential business and labor summits which have been held early in the year. Now, if we look at the implications of the new growth path for the labor market, the focus is on improving the quality of employment for the majority, which requires strong laws, support for workers' voice, skills development, and high employment levels. There are specific proposals around labor market regulation, which include greater protection for workers on short-term contracts or in outsourced positions, limiting the access to easier dispute settlement procedures for very senior managers who can afford legal support to abuse the system, support for sectoral and workplace-based productivity accords that ensure both growth and a fair share of benefits, support for farm worker organizations. And our colleagues in labor will no doubt elaborate on these issues in their presentation. There is a question about whether or not wages are too high. It is difficult for us to undertake international benchmarking exercises given the exchange rate problems and the unusually large inequalities which are linked to race, sector, and skills. But the total share of remuneration, as illustrated in the graph, the total share of remuneration in the GDP declined until the late 2000s, but has stabilized since there. And that's the bold line which you see there. It's not the broken lines or the colored lines. It's the bold line there. Manufacturing and government have seen a rise in the share of labor in value added, but mining has seen a large sharp fall. The NGP, if we read the detailed text, does propose moderation at the top, but improvements for the worst off. And indeed, the whole issue of executive pay is a concern of the society. And again, it has recently been in the public discourse and debate with a lot of concern around the salary levels as well as the bonuses awarded to senior executive managers. Youth unemployment. In most countries, youth unemployment is around twice the average unemployment rate. In South Africa, the unemployment rate for youth under 30 is 42%, compared with 17% for older workers. That is again, a worrying statistic. But we cannot solve youth joblessness without growing overall employment levels. So I think this is something we think is very important, that we need to grow the overall employment levels, because otherwise we'll end up with displacement and divisions. It will lead to a lot of divisiveness in society if we have displacement taking place through interventions which we may make around youth employment. So we are working on a multi-pronged strategy which is centered on substantially upscaling the community work program. There are targets for youth in the expansion in employment targeted by the new growth path. Rural development must be a key push in this area because youth are disproportionately located in the former Bantustan areas, and the Comprehensive Rural Development Program has initiated programs in this regard in terms of national youth employment schemes. Improving education, training, and healthcare, especially in poor communities, and the expansion of internships and apprenticeships under the Skills Accord, targeting 3% of the public service initially, building up to 5%. In terms of human resource development and the new growth path, we recognize that education and skills are necessary and critical, but they are insufficient to increase employment levels. 33% of adults with less than a matric are employed, 48% of adults with matric, and 79% of adults with post-matric are employed. Inequalities in skill do mean inequitable economic outcomes. So shortages at the top lead to higher incomes, while lack of jobs for lower skilled depress pay for ordinary workers. South Africans do have more or less the same number of years of schooling as workers in middle income countries, but we lag behind due to deep inequalities which lead to unacceptable quality in most black communities, especially around maths and science, and especially in the rural areas and informal settlements. The share of the labor force with tertiary education and universities are still highly unrepresentative. And this emerges quite clearly in the panel on the right there. And weak vocational training systems lead to a shortage of artisans in particular. There's also skills bottlenecks, artisans, tertiary, project management, design. So we have set targets, 30,000 engineers and 50,000 artisans by 2014-15. The increase in the intake of FETs to 1 million by 2014, but the need to deal with the severe throughput problems, computer skills in all secondary schools, adult basic education and training, and for public servants. Although initial targets are agreed with Department of Higher Education and Training, findings on throughput problems in FET mean they need to be reviewed carefully. In terms of overcoming inequality, inequitable education systems based on race and location are central to an inequality of opportunity. In the late 1990s, government did establish systems to ensure skills development supports social mobility, but they have not been implemented strongly. There are proposals which include the targeting of 1.2 million workers to receive certified workplace skills development a year from 2013. Targeting 10% of workers in every sector per year, improvement of CETA governance, accountability, and administrative systems with a focus on identification of sector skills needs, and reviewing FET, HET, and apprenticeships to ensure greater access for learners from disadvantaged schools. The Skills Accord, which we've distributed includes a number of commitments, including that CETAs will refocus on supporting the jobs vision in the new growth path. Employers will train more than their own companies need, and labor will recognize the special status of trainees. Employers will increase training, the spend on training to between 3% and 5% of the payroll. And business and government will make internship places available to students from FET colleges, universities of technologies, and lecturers. Government will also set training targets in every state-owned enterprise. So these are some of the core commitments which are made in the National Skills Accord. Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, the new growth path is a comprehensive response to the structural crisis of poverty, unemployment, and inequality, which is based on solidarity across society. The question is, can we do it? We need to recognize that there's no silver bullet. There's no one thing that we can do to achieve these objectives. We certainly need to transform deep-rooted and complex systems, systems and structures that have evolved over centuries, as we know. Fragmentation of the state is a major problem. It takes a variety of forms. We talk about fragmentation of the state across the spheres. We have had an initiative around the single public service designed to perhaps address this, but there's also fragmentation within the different spheres. And we know that that's a historical problem which is not unique to this country, where we almost have this bureaucratic logic of different departments defining their turf and holding on to it desperately, rather than looking at national objectives and finding ways in which one can cross the boundaries of departmental division in order to achieve our common objectives. We also have decisions that were taken historically, which have led to the breakup of some of the institutions of governance, and this is probably more acute in the area of economic governance, the establishment of multiple agencies, which also replicate and reproduce themselves at provincial levels. We have so many different agencies dealing with things like small business finance, for example, which could be a major driver of employment creation. We've got different institutions at the national level. We're partly addressing this through merging COOLA, SAMAF, and the IDC Small Business Loan Book, but you still have CEDA, you still have the National Empowerment Fund. So we need, in the medium and long term, to look to create a consolidation of different agencies within the state and ensure that state-owned enterprise and public entities really stick to the core mandates of government and do not take on a life of their own. So I think these are some of the challenges. If we want coherence in our policy approach, obviously we need to get coherence within the state. Obviously, prioritization is critical to getting that coherent approach. So we need to ensure that all government programs support a more inclusive economy, especially through employment creation. And as I've indicated, we've established this system where we're trying to get departments to think differently. We need to think differently. We need to work differently. Everything we do, how does it contribute to our core developmental challenge of employment creation? Every department must ask themselves that question, and creating the system, in a sense, forces them, compels themselves to ask themselves that question. In procurement, for example, are we focusing on local procurement? Because as we know, if we focus on local procurement and local content, then we generate jobs in the domestic economy. So departments need to be asking themselves continually whether they are, in fact, doing these things. So That's just an example of what we're trying to do in this regard. Tough decisions will have to be taken. Minds have to be open. And departments need to retool and regear across the entire system in order to focus on employment creation. And we need to work consistently to achieve these objectives. Thank you very much, Chairperson, for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Prof. I called you a Mr. earlier. People get offended. thank you very much, Prof. We are faced with very serious challenges, as you can hear from this presentation, at least. We have people who know, you know, what needs to be done to turn the economy around. What is it that we need to do as a country to reach our goal of creating 5 million jobs by 2020. But at the rate at which we are going, and with different departments and entities not talking to each other, not everybody, because we don't all see the same picture. We don't see the whole picture. In some instances, only people see themselves as their own department in the picture. And if they think they are not in the picture, it means there's nothing is happening. So we need to go beyond the given, actually, to achieve this 5 million jobs by 2020. I was reading an article yesterday, and I even saw it on TV, about 49 jobs having been, 49,306 jobs having been lost just in this last month of August. And for me, these are not very good signs about, you know, it actually means that we need to do something extraordinary, to start doing business in a different manner from the way we've been doing things. I'll give over to Labour to give their presentation, and then after that I'll open for members to ask questions of clarity and or just the debate.
Chairperson, I just want to make a suggestion, and you can overrule me if you feel that it's out of line. I've had a look at the Labour presentation in preparation for this meeting, and every single thing in there we've already received in a presentation. There's nothing new in that presentation. So I'm suggesting that we ask the Labour people that are here today to talk to the presentation we've just had, and perhaps they can highlight the Labour things that they are doing already in that presentation. But we know all the stuff as a committee because we've seen these summaries before, and there's nothing really new in that presentation that we don't already know about. So it will be an hour of rehashing what we already know, whereas this is new stuff, and perhaps this is the important thing that perhaps the Labour representatives could comment on and tell us what they're doing in that sort of area, which we don't know at all. It's new stuff.
No, thanks for that suggestion. But I'll prefer that the Department of Labour should give us a briefing as we agreed. And then from there, we can engage. Over to you, Mr. Kettledas.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Our presentation, as Mr. Ola said, it was always bound to integrate or overlap to an extent with the economic development presentation. Our focus is on Program 7 of the macroeconomic package. As you will see from the new growth path document, the macroeconomic package involves 10 programs. Labour policies is Program 7 of that. And slide 16 of the presentation made by the DG of Economic Development deal with those areas that we are going to elaborate upon. The first issue that we are, of course, covering is the issue of a national productivity accord supplemented by sector and workplace productivity agreements. In the economic development presentation, the issue that they raised there is support for sectoral and workplace-based productivity accords to ensure both growth and a fair share in benefits. In the presentation that we are putting forward, we are elaborating here, giving some information as to what Productivity South Africa is doing, which is a public entity under the auspices of the Ministry of Labour. The Productivity SA are doing a number of initiatives in the area and speaking to sectoral and workplace-based productivity. The entity has established 108 future forums in various workplaces to prevent job losses, and with those initiatives also save 15,500 jobs. What is important also for productivity enhancement is the issue of turnaround strategies that productivity is developing with workplaces so as to prevent job loss from taking place. And in this regard, 46 such company turnaround strategies had been developed. What is also important in the issue of workplace productivity is the establishment of future forums. Now, future forums involve both management and workers at a shop floor level where they are discussing ways and means of improving work organization in order to prevent job loss and also to discuss how they can improve workplace productivity through those future forums. And of course, the Productivity SA has also been working with 105 companies and productivity champions to train them. So we really see that the objective of the new growth path could build on those initiatives that Productivity SA has already is already undertaking. And from that, we could then see the development of a national productivity accord that is supplemented by sector and workplace productivity agreements. So we really see this as important work to build on towards the establishment of a national productivity accord. In regard to the legislative amendments, and I'm sure this year where Honourable Ollis referred to that, there are legislative amendments. The NGP calls for legislative amendments to produce workers to reduce workers' vulnerability by addressing problems experienced in contract work, subcontracting, outsourcing, and labour broking, and including decent work considerations in the procurement processes consistent with the electoral mandate. And as we had reported already, this is currently being addressed through several amendments to the key legislation that the department is administering, and that process is underway in NEDLAC. So the whole range of issues that are being raised in the new growth path are issues that are now subject to negotiations for amendments to the legislation to deal with those areas. Also, in regard to the CCMA, the economic development presentation raises the issue of limiting access to dispute settlement procedures for very senior managers and professionals who have access to other dispute settlement systems, but tie up the process with procedural points and generally to further improve cost-effective services to workers and employers. And similarly, in this regard, there are several amendments to particularly the Labor Relations Act that would be dealing with this issue and resolving that issue to meet the objective of the new growth path. Expanding the role of the UIF in funding DFI efforts to create employment and extending employment services to assist unemployed to find employment. This is not particularly covered in the economic development presentation, but it is in the new growth path. As is reported also in the annual report now that has been tabled in Parliament of the Unemployment Insurance Fund, the Unemployment Insurance Fund has invested 35 billion out of its 52 billion reserves in commercial socially responsible investment portfolios that support the creation and sustaining of jobs. And that will continue to to be done. The UIF also, to stimulate job creation, invested 2 billion rand private placement bond with the IDC. And the IDC reports indicate that the investment has had a positive impact on job creation and retention. Thus far, 1 billion rand has been approved for a total of 76 transactions, creating about 10,000 new jobs and saving more than 7,000 existing jobs. And obviously, with the balance of the funds, we are looking at more jobs being saved or more jobs being created. It has also funded participants in the training layoff scheme, saving 3,000 employees that are in fact paying UIF or have been paying UIF from being retrenched in sectors ranging from clothing and textile to motor car manufacturing. And of course, that training layoff scheme will continue, and we are looking at ways and means of enhancing that contribution that the training layoff scheme is making. Then in regard to improvements, it is also in the new growth path listed, improvements to the functioning of labor centers in order to improve information about employment and training opportunities. This is also not covered in the economic development presentation, but it is in terms of the new growth path an area that we must pursue. Through the 125 labor centers that we have around the country, the 73 Tusong centers where our services are being delivered, as well as 20 mobile truck visiting points, we have been able to register over 650,000 job seekers across the country. We have provided career counseling to 65,000 people, and those are to help people into jobs. 15,900 were assessed on the SPEAK system, which is determines their suitability for employment. 12,700 were placed in jobs, and 2,400 were placed in scarce skills employment, and over 450,000 were referred for UIF benefits to the compensation fund and to higher education and training for further training. And that, we believe, is an important service to render through the labor centers and those visiting points, be they Tusong visiting points or be they through the mobile units that go out into the deep rural areas. Then, lastly, Chairperson, the issue linking up again with the economic development presentation around farm worker organization. The specific objective is that measures to support the organization of the unorganized, in particular farm workers, should be implemented. And what we have done towards meeting this objective is that we have commissioned a study to identify the obstacles to union organization on farms, so that we can work towards a decent work strategy for the farming sector. This study is currently being completed, and we would be engaging with the findings and the recommendations of that study in order then to take forward what measures we should then implement, be it legislative or otherwise, in order to support the building organization of particularly farm workers. We couldn't do anything unless we understand what are the obstacles. We know what some of them are, but we need to have a comprehensive assessment of what the situation is. We know farms are far and wide spread. It's difficult for organizers, it's capacity issues of unions in order to organize. So this study is being completed now, and we will soon be able to engage with the outcome of that and put in place measures to then try and meet the objective of the new growth path in this area. We were asked about the issue of adherence of foreign companies to South African labor laws. Now, the point we want to make here is that the inspections are conducted across all companies within the borders of the Republic, irrespective of their ownership. We don't distinguish that this is a foreign company, this is a local company. If we inspect wholesale and retail, we inspect all companies in wholesale and retail. We're not focusing on the ownership of the companies during inspections, but whether or not they comply with the legislation that they are obliged to comply with. So that, Chairperson, is our presentation linking up with the economic development presentation, and specifically in the area that we have responsibility for under the new growth path. And of course, on a more broader level, we are working within the economic sector, a cluster of departments. We are a participant in that, and we participate in not just this area of the new growth path, but in the wider issues of taking the growth path implementation forward. Thank you very much.
Material. What has happened to that? and see if they cannot help us in our way forward. Over to you, honourable members. I'll give over to the rural man, honourable Masrumu.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks to the presentations. Chair, I just want indulgence with the gathering on these following issues. As you can see, I'm growing beard. And I'm getting thinner and thinner because I'm afraid to die. And I'm getting older, not anymore younger. I've been around for so long, you can imagine. Having worked in the centers, mining, agriculture, fiber class, motor industry sector, conditions that were existing then, they still exist. And I agree with you fully, as you say, there is no silver bullet. We can't do a single thing because everything else is linked to everything. Everything else is born out of everything. I fully agree. But then I'm getting confused as to, because you see, every time you go to a workshop, you go to a conference, you listen to a symposium, speaking, they tell you Cancun, COP 16, now COP 17, they tell you blah, blah. Wara wara, quara quara, so on and so forth. And everybody else tells you about the complexity of the situation. See, the discussions goes on and on. And this generation dies, the other one comes, this one dies, the other one passed by, goes on. When is the cut of date? Roughly. Just using one's imagination. When do we say this is enough? We cut off here. When are we going to do that? Because you see, I'm looking at the greening economy. If you go to the rural areas, for instance, when I grew up, you would love to stay there. When I was young, the environment was so green. We used to go out and remove that all over the places, plastics and you'd see birds flying around, you'd hear frogs singing songs all over. Now since we become industrialized, rivers are running dry, there are no birds, you can't get anything now. And the discussions are going on and on and on. And structures are being established, structure after structure. Government after government. Now, recently, we are talking of fragmentation of government structures, local, provincial, district, so on and so forth, parastatal. You talk of all sorts of things. And all of them, they make money out of the poor. They don't make money out of the rich. All of them. You name them. Every single structure take money out of the poor. Now, when do we cut off date? When is the cut off date? When are the rich going to say, no, we are rich enough now? We can consider certain things. I mean, this is my worry, really, because I'm just about to die. How many more should I wait that before I die to hear these things again and again and again? Finally, Chair, Can I ask two things before I go out and call it a day? We hear talk of. I just need to be explained two things here. If we talk of professionalism, can you also talk of commitment? Professionals who are also committed. Can they link up and make sense? Because we are talking of lack of skills. How many people are out of university currently? How many professionals do we have? Are they committed to what they are doing? Or are they committed to being professionals only without commitment? How do we explain this? And lastly, how do we explain the words we are using in our debates in boardrooms? You hear people talking of underdevelopment, middle income, high income, developing. What exactly is this? How do you unbundle these things to be able to say South Africa is here now? Underdeveloped, developing, middle income, high income countries. Where can you say South Africa is located currently when we continue to use this kind of words? And when can we say quickly, according to what I see in this booklet, when will that be? When can we reach agreement? Because here we talk of the hallmark of implementation. When can we quickly say we are beginning to implement these ideas, these programs, these policies? Because we continue to go to meetings, to workshops, to symposiums, but these things are not being implemented. When quickly can we say it's enough? We are going to start implementing. I'm just trying to imagine what is possible, what is not. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Honorable Masrumu. Then the question still remains, in terms of the MDGs, there is one who said that we need to reduce extreme poverty. Now, there are different definitions of extreme poverty or of poverty. But in South Africa, what is the poverty datum line for South Africa? Is it still one? Is it $1 a day people who earn or consume less than $1 a day, or is it $3 or $5? Because I think they'll differ from country to country based on their country. But what is ours in South Africa? What is the extent of extreme poverty in this country? Honorable Ollis, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Chairperson. I see the DG isn't here as he sent apologies, so I thought he was coming. Anyway, I'll focus on this document. I'd like to speak to the document presented by the Economic Development Department. So thank you for the presentation. I have some comments and questions. The way I went through the document and listened to your presentation, what you've said to us are several things. You've said to us that the job situation and poverty and the income disparity in South Africa is a problem, and you've given us a lot of graphs to illustrate that. You then pointed to the new growth path and what it aims to do, and you've said broadly two things. The first one is a lot of social change is necessary, and then you've given us kind of a smorgasbord of social changes that are needed, a bunch of different things. And then the second thing you've said is we need jobs growth. The difficulty as a Labour Portfolio Committee on dealing with this is that those are two quite different goals. Social change involves lots of things. Feeding children at school to make sure that they go to class without an empty stomach, and the apartheid spatial planning and how the transportation system must link that all up, and that these are all social problems that need to be addressed, but they're not really linked directly to jobs growth. And perhaps I've misunderstood what the new growth path is all about, but I understood that the new growth path was about growth and mainly jobs growth, because we have an economy that sometimes grows, but when it does grow, it often doesn't produce any jobs. So we have lots of people unemployed, and our biggest social crisis, if you want to put it in that term, is the lack of real jobs, new jobs. And when the economy grows, we don't get any jobs. We just get some more money in the director's pocket, but we don't get real jobs. So this document is a bit difficult to deal with because it's got this, these two foci, the two focuses, the two issues blended together in this way that leaves us with this, you know, for example, on page 14, I mean, there's a whole hodgepodge of priorities here. So I need to ask you the question, what is the goal of the new growth path? Is there one goal, or are there a whole smorgasbord of goals? Because I think that if we aim at everything, we're going to achieve nothing. This page 14 is just one example of this document where, you know, facilitate social dialogue. That's not going to produce any jobs. Might reduce the fights and arguments at NEDLAC, which I'm sure the NEDLAC people will be glad about, but it's got nothing to do with jobs. You know, work closer with stakeholders and meetings under NEDLAC. You know, you say that we're going to get an agreement to start with the low-hanging fruit. That's a very kind of random statement in the middle here, and you did try to explain it, but it's still not clear. Which low-hanging fruit are we targeting, and are these low-hanging fruit focused on creating jobs, or what? What kind of low-hanging fruit? A lot of statements in this document are generalizations and very difficult to deal with as a Labour committee. Greater protection page, well, this one doesn't have a page number. If we go from 14 onwards, 15, I suppose it would be page 16, but it doesn't have a number. On that page, you talk about specific proposals on labour market regulation. Well, I know this is the Labour Committee, but is this going to produce growth, greater protection for workers? Can you explain to me how greater protection for workers is going to produce growth? Does the new growth path really say we must have greater protection for workers in order to produce growth? Because I find that a startling statement. Limiting access to dispute settlement procedures for senior managers, how is that going to produce growth? Productivity, I understand, of course. Support for farm worker organization, I'm sure that's not even good English, it should be organizations. But how does support for farm worker organizations help growth? I mean, it's not about growth. It's about social problems that we have, and we have lots of social problems. I'm not diminishing the social problems. But I understood that the new growth path, Chairperson, was going to produce growth so that we could have more jobs and more money in work. But there are lots of other things here that I just don't know whether they have anything to do with growth. So I think there's a, for me, as a member of the Labour Committee, there's a bit of a confusion about what the new growth path is supposed to achieve. And this is our first, if I'm correct, Chairperson, our first presentation on the new growth path in the Labour Committee. And I appreciate the presentation. There's a lot of detail in here, but it's left me a little bit confused as to what the goal of the new growth path is, whether it's social engineering, or whether it's economic growth, or whether it's jobs growth, or what it is, because of the nature of this presentation. One understands the inequalities, one understands the need for spatial integration and transport integration, all these other things, but are they going to help us achieve growth? Page 22, I have a specific question, Chairperson. There's a statement on page 22. In the late 1990s, government established systems to ensure skills development supports social mobility, but not implemented strongly, in brackets CETAs and SAQUA. Page 22. It's in the category of overcoming inequality again, which my question is the Economic Development Department telling us that the CETAs and SAQUA are failing, or are they not delivering, or what are they telling us about the CETAs and about SAQUA? We have our own problems with SAQUA and so on, but I'm wondering what you're saying about the CETAs and SAQUA. Not implemented strongly, does that mean they didn't do their job properly, or they did partially achieve their job, their target, or what is it that they didn't achieve? I like the point on page 23 about employers to train more than their own companies need and for labourers to recognise the special status of trainees. I think that is important, and I think that does contribute to jobs. It's specific. Take some people, you train them, you take more than you need, and you ask labour to recognise the special status of trainees because they might have to have special conditions of employment. That's a good idea. I like that. Your page, can we do it? You say there's no silver bullet, and you say then the critical first step is clear prioritisation. That's exactly my concern after having listened to this presentation. What is the priority? Because it sounds like there are priorities, many of them. And I know government needs to have all of those priorities, but does the new growth path need to have all of those priorities? Because it sounds like, if I could use your analogy, it sounds like instead of a silver bullet, we've gone for several shotguns all firing at once. And that achieves lots of, you know, chaos, but it doesn't achieve a specific goal. So apologies if that doesn't come across well, but I'm just trying to find out what the focus is, because I'm a little bit confused after listening. Thank you very much.
We seriously need a gun-free society. Honorable Ollis, we don't need so many guns, please. Honorable Makubele Mashele, thank you.
Thanks, Stan. I just want to be clarified on part of the presentation here on, I think it's page 9, which speaks to the government's action on all kinds of employment and the basis for improvement. I just want to get clarity on what is meant by the state's action and whether the monitoring and the evaluation will be on, because you spoke of all spheres of government. You're saying you are going to derive a mechanism to monitor and evaluate all spheres of government on the state's action on all kinds of employment. I just want to know whether this means the state creating employment or the employments that are created as when the state creates environments that are conducive to create more employment. Just a clarity on that. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Sevens. Honorable Nyagemba.
Thank you very much. I think let me join my colleagues in welcoming the two presentations. I think in the sense they do try to indicate the implications of the new growth path vis-a-vis the labor legislations. The one area that I would like to be clarified on is on slide 23. Well, I've always welcomed that, and I don't welcome it. Hence, one needs some further clarification of what do you mean? That employers to train more than their own companies need. I understand that part. But the one that follows, that says, and labor to recognize the special status of trainees. What do you mean? I'm raising this because I foresee a situation where, one, you have labor legislation that exists that cover all those who are in workplaces. Now, from where I'm sitting, unless that's why I need to, I want to be corrected. Are you then saying there must be a legislation that says those who are trainees, there are certain labor legislations that they don't have to enjoy. Is it what you are trying to mean? If that's what you mean, do you then call that are you creating employment? What are you trying to do? But I need clarity, sir, in that area. Thank you.
Thanks. Is there any other hand from the members? The job creation, it's seriously a problem, and it's a very serious problem. It's of serious challenges to the country, particularly to young people who have gone to school for many years and trying to learn some of the learning some of the so-called rare skills in the country. It's very, very sad where a young person who comes from university, having done chemical engineering, of this boy in Lewahomo, is a township near my village, who went to school here, UCT, and did chemical engineering and passed it. He is what we call in the township Lepak Shop. You know what Lepak Shop means? It means it's not French. It means somebody who walks to the shop in the morning during the day and parks there the whole day. Play dice, wash taxis, and then chat anyone who goes to the shops and back to the village or the township. That's what this boy does now. From the township near my village. What kind of message is this sending to kids who are at school now at Matric? That rather than go to school, if you can learn how to speak Chinese, you can make a lot of money because then you can become a tourist guide. So going to university is no longer an opportunity of taking your family out of poverty. For some people, it sounds like investing money in the education of your child to learn a skill. It doesn't pay because the child is not going to get a job even if they are qualified with those rare skills. We need to talk to some of the laws that are making this kind of thing possible, where companies will apply that we need 7 engineers, chemical engineers, for our chemical plant or for the mine in a particular area. And then without checking how many people we have with those skills in the country, then we give those companies those permits. And that's why now our local citizens, very young people, end up with skills and no jobs. So, and jobs is not only about putting people into jobs, it's not about salary. A job gives you dignity. You know, when a person wakes up in the morning with a torn, clean overall, with a scarf tin in his plastic bag, even when you greet that person, in my language we say Bashumi, which means workers. You know, it means this person belongs to a particular category, where when he's greeted or she's greeted, she's called by that title. And if you are not, what title are you going to be called with? Lover. No, lover can even mean so, but it means an unemployed person. But which actually says that unemployment, it actually means that unemployment will have impact even on petty crime, you know, in the townships and villages. So the sooner, the more we have these databases in terms of before we declare certain skills rare and that we need to import them, let us look internally in this country. Do we have this kind of skills in the country? I said in the last meeting that that we had with the Portfolio Committee on Home Affairs and Economic Development, that if you take health workers out of the British health system and just say by tomorrow everybody goes back to Southern Africa, the British health system will collapse, because there are a lot of South African experienced doctors and nurses, very senior nurses, including social workers, who are servicing the working in the English health ministry. And while we even say that we still have shortage of nurses in South Africa when we're exporting them, I think there was something where Honorable Oli said about saving jobs and creating jobs. You're talking about job creation. But you see, it doesn't help you if you lose a job and create one the following day. It becomes like a recycling program. I know this is not what you are saying. But what I'm saying is that we have to focus on programs. What are this kind of programs that will help us to create jobs? When we invest monies from our entities, like we're talking as the UIF or the compensation fund, those millions, what are they investing those millions in? Are they investing it in bullions, where they'll just buy, you know, gold from somewhere, or invest in some IT company in Japan and then get money? That money, it's not, you're investing in a thing that does not benefit us in South Africa, that is not creating jobs. So we need to look at, where do we actually put our investment monies as the country, particularly even as the Department of Labor? Are we putting it with entities that will be able to create more jobs? Are we investing in small industries? Like if you look at most rich people or fashionable people in South Africa wear Italian suits. And I'm told most of these big labels started in garages in Italy because they were supported by the government to do that. You know, why can't we take a risk and invest in these things, knowing that we'll create jobs and even upskills of our people? Thank you. I'll give over to anyone who wants to respond from the Economic Development and Labour. Over to you. Thank you.
thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm going to respond together with my colleague, Dr. Magetla, to the issues that have been raised by the honourable members. I do think it's important to recognise at various points the limitations of the words on the page. The Honourable Masire Mula is in fact doing that when he says how long, at which point do we actually say enough is enough. I suppose he is lamenting ongoing discussions in the boardrooms while we have a bloodbath out there on the ground of people losing jobs. And a problem of us agreeing on programs and priorities without ever implementing them. I think that is an accurate observation, and I think he's made the observation. But in order to extend the answer to that question, I'm sorry, I don't know all the honourable members' names. I didn't quite get...
Hollis.
Okay. The Honourable Hollis is concerned that we are all over the place, that we aren't aiming with a gun or a telescope, we're just shooting in all directions. I think that's the metaphor he used for the new growth path. But I do think that we are confronted with fundamental developmental problems. And development is really about connecting the dots between the social and the economic in particular. Our fundamental developmental challenge is job creation. I think that's clear. It emerges from the growth part because the growth part puts employment creation at the center. But obviously, the issue of poverty is linked to it, and the issue of economic exclusion is linked to it. Now, what a socio-economic approach does is it connects the dots. It brings the issues together. So I don't think that we are scattered all over the place. We are recognizing that there are a number of problems in the society. We are recognizing the source of those problems. But if we don't connect the dots, if, for example, we say what we need is growth, and we don't unpack that growth, what is that growth? Then we end up back where we are, with financialization of the economy driving growth, which does not create jobs. And that's why we showed the importance of labor absorbing growth in this presentation. The fact that we need a quality of growth that creates jobs, not growth in itself. Growth in itself will be a good statistic on a page, but it will not create jobs. So we need particular kinds of interventions with particular kinds of priorities. And we need to build a consensus in the society in order to achieve this. And that's why social dialogue should not perhaps be criticized in the way that the Honorable Member has. Because it's not just about words, it's about commitments. The commitments which you, Honorable Member, have applauded to some extent, or in some areas of this accord you have endorsed these particular commitments. If we don't protect our workers, we will not have development because we will see unemployment increasing. There are people in society who are extremely vulnerable, and these people need to get protection. If the state is unable to intervene in the manner in which a developmental state intervenes, we are going to get increased polarization in the society. If we are unable as executives, be us in the private sector, the parastatal sector, the public service, are unable to see that if we are not willing to look objectively at our own salaries in relation to the mass of the workers out there, we get ongoing polarization in society. If we say that 20% of women in our society are domestic workers employed at 1,000 rand a month or less, when some of us are earning in the region of 100,000 rand a month, we need to build a consensus which begins to say, what are we willing to give in order to ensure that the majority of those who are marginalized are able to pull themselves out of marginalization. Now, social dialogue, that is the big goal, if you like. But to get there, we need to work on the areas of consensus. And the Skills Accord is an example of an area where we're able to build consensus. Local procurement, absolutely fundamental. And this relates to the Honorable Makubela Mashele's question as well. Is in everything we do, we procure as government and the state-owned enterprises literally billions on an annual basis. Now, we need to ensure that whatever it is that we procure is sourced locally and adheres to a certain standard of local content. That's what the DTI is working on. They're working on a framework through the amendments to the regulations of the PFA that will ultimately designate certain sectors where the state will have to procure goods produced locally with a certain percentage of local content. And that will be critical in driving local job creation. It relates to the question, but it does not perhaps cover everything in the question of the Honourable Makubele Mashele, and I'll still come back to elements of the Honourable Ollis's question. We recognise that the majority of job creation comes from the private sector in this country. 80 to 85% of job creation comes from the private sector. But the state has a direct and indirect impact on job creation. Directly, the state has employees. Directly, the state can introduce what we call the short-term job opportunity creation through the expanded public works programs, the community works programs. But obviously, at a national level in particular, the pursuit of policies by the core economic departments, be it agriculture, mineral resources, the DTI, will impact indirectly on job creation as well. So when we monitor this, the impact of state action, we're asking departments, what is your direct impact? What is your indirect impact? In the case of the big policy-making departments at national level in the economic sector, they will have a much bigger indirect impact on job creation than other departments may have. Department of Public Service Administration, for example, will not necessarily have that major an impact, although it regulates across the public service, so it may have a bigger impact than other departments. But the example of procurement I've given, and there are departments which procure in a major way, health, education. Let's go back to the question of the Honourable Ollis. How do we connect the dots? If we say in the Honourable Chairperson's village, there are numbers of people who have skills in construction, how do we harness that potential? Is there any way in which we procure, be it for the maintenance of schools, can we give opportunities to people at that level in the maintenance of school buildings? Or do we run procurement from a provincial level and bring in outside service providers? How do we use the opportunities which the state has around procurement to enhance job creation opportunities for people across the entire length and breadth of the country? These are the things we're asking departments to think seriously about. Think seriously about how, in all your actions, for example, as I've indicated through procurement, that you can directly or indirectly enhance employment creation opportunities. On the proposals in the labor market, how does support for farm worker organization? Well, it could be organizations and it could be organization. I think both are perfect English. I don't think that is really the point. But farm workers are highly vulnerable. We see agriculture shedding jobs on an ongoing basis. And that has a major developmental impact. It pulls those who are already poor into deeper poverty. And hence the importance, because through organization we have empowerment. When people are organized, they become empowered. When people are organized, they take advantages or they take advantage of the opportunities which the state provides through a number of different initiatives. Hence, organization of farm workers is fundamental to livelihood sustainability, if I can put it that way. That's why it's important for us in the New Growth Path, because the New Growth Path is trying to address the fundamental challenges of creation of employment and creation of sustainable livelihoods. That's why it's critical for us to talk to that particular matter. I think I'm going to ask my colleague Dr. Machetla to talk to a number of the issues that were raised, including the performance of the CETAs and SAQA, as well as the question of the trainees in the Skills Accord and any other issues that I may not have touched on in the input I've given. Thank you.
Okay, I just want to add something on the farm workers, which is now, you see, speaking as an economist also, that you can't get these labor market outcomes if people are unable to negotiate properly. And so you want people, that's why government supports unions, because it sets up a negotiations framework, which is much less imperfect than if you have individuals trying to negotiate the condition of vulnerability and imperfect information. So the argument is we end up setting basic minimum wages for farm workers. Better they should be organized and negotiate their own wages. So there's a straight economics argument why you would prefer workers to be organized. Having said that, the poverty line, look, as I'm sure you know, the poverty line can be defined in different ways. Because we are a middle-income economy, that is to say, rather than using these loaded words like development, we tend to prefer to use numbers which just refer to the GDP per capita. As a middle-income economy, we generally use the figure of $2 a day. Because we have such big inequalities, we have very high poverty rates. So about 40% of the of households are earning less than that, if you look at $2 per day per person. The way they arrived at the international poverty line is they just looked at what you actually need to survive, and it came out to be actually fairly uniform across different economies. The problem is defining what is acceptable is also socially defined. So, you know, somebody who's poor in the U.S. would be richer often. And by the same token, somebody who's poor in a middle-income economy like South Africa might be well off compared to very poor economies. So we would argue that at a minimum $2 a day per person, and like I said, that means that 40% of the population lives in poverty. I think more useful is to say, where are they? And I think what's interesting is that disproportionately in the former Bantustan regions, and that we haven't, that's why this spatial issue becomes so important. Look, the thing about the CETAs and the SAQA, it's where the SAQA, that the, you know, the South African qualifications framework was supposed to ensure that people who were deprived of an adequate basic education and training in their youth could nonetheless catch up. And I think everybody sitting here would agree that that qualifications framework has not been fully implemented and hasn't had that effect. Now, maybe it wasn't possible, maybe it was too complicated, but the fact is that did sort of fall off the table as a major initiative. And also the CETAs, we think, did not do enough to, I mean, we think they've done a lot, don't get us wrong, we think they've made, obviously, and our colleagues here know much more about it, some of them much more about it than we do, made a huge impact, but we still need to do more to ensure that ordinary workers have access to qualifications and that those qualifications are linked to career paths so that they also support equity. Because I would totally agree with my DG, obviously, that in a country that is where the economy has been deformed as it has been in South Africa, you simply cannot talk about growth as the only objective. I think that that will just create jobs or equity. And there's many studies that show that highly inequitable economies, in fact, do not grow because of the kinds of policy debates and divisions that arise, and that's also why social dialogue is so important. So I think it's simplistic to think we can just sit here like an ordinary economy and say we'll just go for growth and that will solve everything, because clearly it won't. So all we're saying there is that the initiative there was important. The idea that we needed to have lifelong learning, given particularly the apartheid history, given the problems with education even now, that we need to make sure lifelong learning is available to all workers is an important thing, and we need to put that back on the table. And that's why the growth path says we want to target skills development for 10% of the labor force every year. I do think, you know, you look at the economies that have succeeded, like the economies of Asia, and all the studies show that one of the big things in Asia is at least for men, you can walk in the doors an ordinary worker and rise to the highest levels in that company. That's never been true here, and it's still not true here. And if we don't sort that out, that kind of social mobility is critical for a dynamic economy. In terms of the trainees, I think the argument is that skills development shouldn't create employment by creating positions of trainees. It should create employment by enabling workers to take advantage of economic opportunities and increasing the efficiency and productivity of the economy as a whole. So the trade-off there is to agree that trainees are not permanent employees. If they're being trained in addition to the needs of the company, that they're effectively contract employees. Now, I don't think the agreement spells out in detail how that will be achieved, but I think the critical thing is if you treat them as contract employees, when they finish their training, then they have to seek a job elsewhere. We're not saying the company must not only train them, but also create a job, because by definition, the company has said they will train people in addition to their needs. That's the argument. And then finally, that's all. I think that, I'm sure we want to thank everybody for their questions and comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jose.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. I'll deal with two questions, the one on sheltered employment factories and the unemployment and compensation fund investment. Just on the sheltered employment factories, I'll agree with you, Honorable Chairperson, that the sheltered employment factories have the capacity to employ additional people. In fact, 2,000 plus people could be employed in those factories. But I think there are a number of challenges that are impacting on the ability of factories to expand currently. And I'll just give you a sense on some of them. Firstly, these factories used to have what we called preferential procurement status, and that has been taken away. What it meant was that previously, government departments had to purchase furniture and textile from those factories before they could go anywhere. Now, with the removal of preferential procurement by National Treasury, it means that these factories have to compete with all other factories up front and in terms of tendering and all that. And secondly, given the people that we have in those factories, people living with various levels of disabilities, there are challenges in competing with mainstream industries. The other thing is that because of the principle that you cannot pay for goods that are not delivered, it simply means that the sheltered employment factories must use their own reserves to upfront buy the raw materials after securing a contract, manufacture products, and deliver them. And we fought and went to cabinet on a number of occasions with our colleagues. In fact, the CEO, in addressing the Labor Portfolio Committee, did at some stage indicate the frustrations that we have had with government departments after having received linen, after having received that's for the schooling system, furniture, and so on, will basically take their own time or not pay at all and resulting in a situation where the factories find themselves in a very difficult situation. There are a number of things that we are doing to try and rectify the situation. Firstly, in improving productivity, the Productivity SA has been partnered with a number of factories. The Klerksdorp factory and the Johannesburg factory are pilots in this stage, so that we begin to change the way in which they operate the machinery and so on as we get more and young people with disability and through attrition having others retiring. We have been involved in discussions with the military veterans because they have in the region of 20,000 current army personnel that are over the age of 45 that they would in the near future want to lay off Now, the challenge in having to deal with this situation over and above the veterans that are currently unemployed is how do you actually expand factories of this nature? Social development has plus minus 300 similar factories across the country. And the issue is securing markets for products produced in these factories, because if we don't have guarantees we can employ people in those factories, you'll struggle with market and the amount of subsidies. And we're involved in a process with National Treasury to try and make to develop business cases that may, with National Treasury support, see an opening in terms of procurement where we can begin to actually secure sales for products produced in these factories, including expansion in terms of employing youth and veterans. And just briefly on the investments of reserves collected by both UI and CF. UI has in excess of 52 billion and CF in excess of 27 billion rand collected from the UIF contributions and the compensation for occupational diseases and injuries. Now, one of the responsibilities of the boards of both UI and CF is to invest reserves with the assistance of actuaries in bonds that will do a number of things. Firstly, the boards determines the kind of what we call commercial socially responsible investment portfolios. Now, this will include the central government, the municipalities, the parastatals such as Eskom, South African Airways, Transnet, and so on. And we invest this money through the Public Investment Corporation. We have an agreement in there. Now, most of these investments yield very, very little returns. Some would yield returns of 5%. Some basically is zero, like IDC. The returns there are almost zero. You give them 2 billion at the end of the day, you collect again 2 billion from them after a certain period. Where else in the commercial ones, depending on the margins that the actuaries would advise us, you then go for the normal bank rate. And that is to ensure that whilst you are losing money on other areas that are socially responsible, you also generate some income so that you protect the liquidity of both funds. But the bulk is moving towards the social responsible projects. Now, most of the big projects that we're having in the country, the highways, the improvement of the airports, and expansion of railways and so on, are also benefiting a lot from the UI and CF investment, because they do borrow this money from the Public Investment Corporation. The challenge that we have identified in the department was to hold these entities accountable in terms of clearly stating the number of jobs that they've created from the investment and the monies that they've borrowed from us. And in as part of our process of amending our investment agreement, we are addressing that aspect, Honorable Chairperson, so that we can also indicate, or we are in a position to say through the investments that both the UI and compensation fund made with the PIC, these are the number of jobs created and in these areas, etc. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson.
Does anyone want to have a fight on this issue? Honorable members, we think we come to the end of our of our joint meeting, joint briefings by both the Department of Labor and Economic Development. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the professor, your team, and our friends here. We meet all the time. But we have to thank you too for being here today with us again. And I think this will help us in our future interaction, even with other portfolio committees, and even us in our engagement with the Department of Labor. Thanks for this information.